Welcome to Puro Politics, the political podcast of the San Antonio Express News. My name is Gilbert Garcia, Metro columnist, and I'm joined by
business editor and columnist Greg Jefferson.
Investigative reporter Brian Chasnoff.
And since we last talked to you all, been some developments in, on the state level, some big developments. We've had, after two quorum breaks from Texas House Democrats trying to block the passage of a restrictive election bill, that bill did pass the House last week by an 80-41 vote. It was basically along party lines, with one notable exception, which was San Antonio Republican Lyle Larson, who voted against it. And we're going to talk a little bit more about him in a minute. Also, we have continuing confusion, legal confusion over mask mandates and vaccine mandates that local governments and school districts have imposed. We've had Governor Greg Abbott trying to stop them, and the court fights are really, really hard to keep up with. One interesting development last week was we had had SAISD impose a vaccine mandate for their employees, and Attorney General Ken Paxton sued SAISD, saying that an executive order from Governor Abbott had stipulated that if you could not mandate vaccines that were administered under emergency use authorization. Well, last Monday, the FDA approved the Pfizer vaccine, gave it full approval, and the reaction from Greg Abbott was to issue a new executive order, which basically made clear that even under full authorization, under in any condition, you could not impose a vaccine mandate. So he's made it clear that he's completely opposed to schools either mandating masks or vaccines. And you know, obviously, there's a lot of concern in the state about the safety of kids, and he's just been extremely stubborn on this. And this is something we're going to be following as we go along. I wanted to talk a little bit. I mentioned Lyle Larson. I wanted to talk a little bit about a development last week, which was that controversial former district attorney Nico LaHood, who was a Democrat when he was district attorney, is seriously considering running for Texas House District 122, which is Lyle Larson's district, and Nico LaHood would run as a Republican in the primary there. Brian, you covered Nico LaHood a lot over the years, and the various scandals or controversies that he got into during his time as DA. Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised that he wants to reintroduce himself to the limelight, because I always felt that Nico was motivated by eyes on him to a certain extent, if you know what I mean. Yeah. He relishes being in the public eye. I think it's interesting that, you know, Nico was always to me seemed like a Democrat who behaved more like a Republican.
Right.
Whereas Lyle Larson seems like a Republican who sometimes behaves more like a Democrat, with his public clashes with Governor Abbott.
Yeah.
And people in his own party and so forth. So it's a super interesting dynamic there. I think, I mean, if Lyle's in a district that embraces his independence and his moderation, then I don't know if Nico's more extreme stances on things such as Islam and anti-vaxxing and so forth would go over very well.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing
maybe about Nico, in the primary.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say the interesting thing about Nico LaHood is that there were people were thinking he'd run for DA again. He said people approached him, and he decided he wanted to deal with bigger issues. But the interesting thing about him is that we really don't have much of a sense of what his stance is on a lot of the issues that the legislature would deal with. As you said, Brian, he was anti-vax, which is going to be, which might play well for among Republicans, but would certainly, bother many people. And it did bother a lot of Democrats when he was DA. He's made some, extremely provocative comments about Islam. But when you talk about issues about the role of the government and the kind of things that the legislature deals with, this isn't the kind of stuff he's ever really shown a lot of public interest in. So I think that's going to be really interesting. Greg, I was curious about your thoughts on Lyle Larson. He hasn't said what his plans are. He's increasingly shown solidarity with independent and third parties, and sounded more like an independent. He not only opposed Republicans on this election bill, he was critical of his party for not supporting Medicaid expansion. He's been critical of Governor Greg Abbott for his opposition to the mask mandates and vaccine mandates. So, do you see could you envision Lyle Larson running again for another term as a Republican in his district?
I mean, it's really hard for me to say. I mean, especially this year, throughout, the regular session and into the special session over the summer, like, he's sounded more and more like an exile from his own party. And this has been, he was never a Democrat. he's a lifelong Republican. But he was a Republican when he was on Bexar County Commissioner's Court. And there, if you want to be an ideologue, if you want to be a bomb thrower on commissioner's court, go for it. But you're not going to get much done. I mean, it's very collaborative body. He was also a city council member, which is, kind of nominally nonpartisan. But there, too, if you want to get anything done in order to get reelected, in addition to helping people in your district, you've got to collaborate. I mean, you've got to, you can't take really rigid ideological positions. And in the legislature, I mean, the politics have just changed around him. He seems exhausted. You read some of his social media posts on Twitter and Facebook, and he does, you get the sense that he's exhausted with his party. So, I wouldn't be surprised if he opted not to run again. I think that's entirely possible. But on the other hand, like, if he decides to, kind of be his own person and just leave it to the voters to choose, like, do you want somebody, a more moderate lawmaker who will call BS when he sees it, regardless of the party, or do you want a bomb thrower? Sure. He could leave that up to the voters. And I think that too could be okay with him. He doesn't, Lyle's never struck me as a person who, he's not going to be Speaker of the House. And, I've not seen anything coming from him of wanting to be a state senator. I get the feeling he's kind of happy just doing his thing. And if he's not doing it in the legislature, he'll go, do something else. So, honestly, it's kind of a non-answer. I think going either way. They're deciding not to run or to run for re-election.
I guess in arguing on behalf of the idea that he could still be a viable Republican candidate in the primary District 122, I mean, there's the fact that in 2018, Greg Abbott got behind the campaign of a challenger of Lyle Larson's, Chris Fales, who had been the mayor of Hollywood Park. And, Greg Abbott was really unhappy with Lyle Larson because, as Lyle Larson often does, I mean, he's a maverick figure in his party, and he criticized the governor on ethics issues and basically for appointing, donors to boards and commissions. And so he got on the wrong side of Greg Abbott. And a lot of people thought, well, this could be the end for Lyle Larson. And it didn't turn out that way at all. So he's been, I think we all know, I mean, when you have personal relationship that goes way back with the people in your district, sometimes that can override some of these ideological questions. I mean, the other thing I would say too is that, when people tend to, call him Rhino, or some Republicans will do that. I mean, this is someone who, when he ran for Congress in 2008, was advocating for a fair tax, which would basically have replaced an income tax and would be like a national sales tax that, is pretty regressive idea that, progressives would hate that sort of idea, but it was rooted in his sort of conservative stance on taxation and the size of government. So he's at the core, he's always been a conservative, but as you pointed out, Greg, the idea of what a conservative is kind of the ground has kind of shifted under his feet.
Yeah. Well, so here's a fun thought exercise, Gilbert. What do you think? Is there any chance that, like, if LaHood gets in this race and he challenges Weil in the primary. Do you think there's any chance that Abbott endorses him? LaHood, that is.
Oh, that's a fascinating idea. I think it's possible. Greg Abbott sort of made peace with Lyle Larson in the 2019 legislative session, but Lyle Larson has been very critical of him this year. I think it's an open question. Abbott may say, it didn't work out the last time. And basically Abbott kind of got burned when he started going up against Republican incumbents in that cycle. So he may just decide I'm going to stay out and see what happens. Mm-hmm. But I mean, another question is, will Lyle Larson run as an independent, for example, for lieutenant governor? Because we had him on our podcast a couple of months ago, and it was on this podcast that he referred to Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick as soulless and a jerk, and said, I think something along the lines of, when you look into his eyes, there's nothing there.
I mean, this might be the case of Nico just, sensing blood in the water, right?
Yeah.
A weakness because...
Yeah.
An opening because Lyle is such a maverick at this point.
And, maybe given the fact that Nico LaHood is an anti-vaxxer, maybe he just thinks this is his time. Now is, this is the perfect opportunity.
Gilbert, did you ask him what his stance is on the COVID vaccine?
We didn't talk about the COVID vaccine. And I mean, that's going to be like an obvious, question when he if he gets into this thing, because that's such a big issue right now. And he talked about his, in the past about his opposition to particular vaccines and his belief that it played a role in his son, ending up on the autism spectrum. But he hasn't made any public statements on this particular vaccine. So, I mean, that's going to be, but again, in a Republican primary, it's going to play one way. And this is gets into the bigger issues that we have with our politics throughout the country, which is that if it plays well in a primary, it's not going to really even matter in a general election because this is a Republican district and there's no way, there's no path to victory for a Democrat in that district. So if he takes a stance that's extreme, if it works with Republican voters, that's really going to be all that matters. There's no price to pay for it in a general election. And this tends to be the case with a lot of districts, Texas, House state districts and congressional districts that you're basically playing to primary voters, all the time. I wanted to talk a little bit about an issue that's come up during the budget process with the city, and it's the issue of police funding. After Austin cut its police budget last year, you had a movement at the state level to basically prevent other cities from doing the same. And so Greg Abbott recently signed into law a bill that would punish cities that of 250,000 or more that cut their police budgets. And the big punishment is that you would lose sales tax revenue. So as the city of San Antonio debates what to do with its police budget, it's really a question of, are we going to increase it? Or are we going to keep it frozen? Because I don't think anybody would really advocate for cutting the budget and facing the penalties that the city would encounter. So we have Jalen McKee Rodriguez, Eastside councilman, who just got elected recently and has really been a strong advocate for rethinking the way we handle the police budget. And he sort of challenged the city on the way it's approached things. He made the point that from 2015 to 2020, we've increased the police budget by 19%, but violent crime has gone up 30%. And he had this quote in response to people who would say that, they'll feel safer if we have more police officers on the street. He said, people will also feel safer if they're not at risk of being evicted. People would feel safer if they could walk on roads with sidewalks and street lights at night instead of on damaged, bumpy, unlit roads. People would feel safer if there weren't shootings happening at after hours clubs. So his point was there are a lot of needs that are being unmet in the city, and maybe the way of dealing with the root causes of crime would be to shift that money over to other departments. Manny Pelias, his fellow council member, took issue with that and said that, that when you're looking at rising crime figures, you have to take into account that the city's population has also grown. So you're going to naturally see some increase in crime. And he said that putting money into the police budget is not merely about violent crime statistics, but about response times, trying to keep response times low, and also just dealing with caseload management and that sort of thing. Greg, I want to start with you. When you look at this issue, what stands out to you about the issue about how we should deal with the police budget?
Well, yeah, I mean, so it's always a really, and this is a total understatement, it's a tricky thing to talk about crime statistics and link them to funding for the police department, just because, I mean, you know, I think Manny Pelias, you know, he obviously had a point. Yeah, this is, you know, the city is growing just over the last decade. You know, the population has grown by a little more than 8%. So we've got more people coming in. But even more importantly, I mean, you know, we're coming out of a COVID-induced recession. Crime rates always increase during economic downturns. There's just a lot of factors at play. So, I mean, and like you said, I mean, nobody on city council is, you know, nobody wants to incur a loss of sales tax revenue by cutting the police budget. I don't think there's even a will to do that. I don't believe that even without that stick that Greg Abbott has forced on them, like I just don't think it would happen. The question is allocation, like how, you know, within the police budget, is there anything they can do to increase community policing? And I think that's probably what it will come down to. I'd be surprised if you have a lot of votes on council for, you know, substantially increasing the police budget. But I think it's going to come down to, well, how within the police department are you divvying up that money? And that's really where the argument is going to be until the council adopts, you know, the budget in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. And I think that Jalen McHugh Rodriguez is also making the point that if you increase it even, you know, 14, 15 million, you know, whatever they're talking about now for this a budget cycle, that every time you're increasing it, then you're kind of locked in because of this state law now. So we're kind of, you know, raising the bottom figure that we can have, and so it becomes harder and harder each year that we're increasing that budget. It's just makes it more difficult to maybe put money into other things. You know, when you, Brian, you covered the police a lot. When you look at this issue, and this is part of, like, you know, the national question of how do we approach law enforcement? How much money should we put into police? Are we serving the community better if we put some of that money into other places? I mean, what stands out to you?
Well, I mean, what the first thing that stands out is that the defund the police movement gained very little traction here in San Antonio, even in the thick of the protests last year.
Right.
So there just doesn't seem to be much of an appetite to even play around with these ideas in this community for whatever reason. I'm sure there are reasons. So I get the sense that this councilman is kind of swimming upstream here on this issue. Mm-hmm. And again, like I always go back to the contract with the police union. I mean, in terms of if he's motivated by concerns about police misconduct, then it seems more, in my mind, rational to, you know, take a look at the some of the provisions when it comes to arbitration and, you know, disciplining officers rather than cutting the budget.
Yeah. And I think that one of the points that people have made, which is true here and elsewhere, is that, you know, a big part of it, I think maybe close to 80% of the police budget is kind of locked in by the terms of the police contract, the contract with the union. So even if you feel like there are things that we could, you know, there are cuts that could be made, a lot of that really has to come through the bargaining process anyway, because your city's hands are sort of tied somewhat. Now you're dealing with state law, which limits you, but you're also dealing with the terms of a contract, which pretty much stipulates, you know, a lot of how you're going to, you know, what you're going to be spending your money on.
Yeah. I mean, I think he is correct in seeing the interconnectedness of these other, you know, what ails the city, the interconnectedness between crime and poverty, et cetera. But reformers are hemmed in by state law to a certain extent.
Well, I think we're going to leave things there. Hope everybody's doing well, and appreciate you all listening, and we'll be back next week. Take care.